Welcome to our last concluding lecture in the 19 Letters series. And we are now going to take a look at a very hot topic. And this is the topic of, is Torim Derech Eretz a Horas Shah? And we could translate Horas Shah as something which was instituted only for an emergency measure. And if you could prove something is only an emergency measure, then clearly it is not L'chadchila, it's not something that you should aim to do, but rather it's b'di'evit, it's something that should be avoided. But if you need to, you could do such a system. Better to stay away from it. Now, if you want to get any good Hirshian annoyed, you could tell them that really, Rav Hirsch's system is entirely Horas Shah. Now, before we look at Rav Hirsch's writings to see if this is true or not, we have to understand, where does this come from? So I think that there are two sources. One source comes from the Hirshian world itself, and the second one from the yeshiva world. So let's discuss both of these sources. So we'll start from the Hirshian camp. Rav Hirsch had a student, and I'm going to read to you from the Sri Deish, from Rav Yaakov Yechiel Weinberg. And this essay can be found in the Sefer Tzvi Tifarto, The World of Hirshian Teachings, on page 97, and the title is Toras Chaim, The Torah of Life as Understood by Rav Hirsch. Now, if you skip to page 104 and go down to the next topic, C, Rav Hirsch's position concerning secular education. And Rav Weinberg starts off, Rav Hirsch's name is synonymous with his educational system known as Torim Derech Eretz. This system has been explained in many different ways. One of Rav Hirsch's students, a respected Orthodox religious communal head, endeavored to defend his mentor before the leaders of the generation by insisting that Rav Hirsch never intended to implement the secular studies component of his system outside of Germany. Only there, this student maintained, due to unique reasons of economic need prevalent at the time, Rav Hirsch proposed such an educational program, forced only to make their livings in business, a field which required familiarity with the highest levels of secular learning. German Jews needed this knowledge to survive. The student professed that Rav Hirsch only permitted secular studies under duress, to comply with government regulations, and to deal with prevailing difficult economic circumstances. However, this analysis is at odds with the historical reality, and Rav Weinberg goes to explain how this is not true. Now, Rav Weinberg does not name this student, and I'm not sure why, but I don't believe it's a secret, and I will tell you who it is. This is the famous Moreno Rabbi Yaakov Rosenheim, who was given, I believe, the only honorary smicha in history, actually by the Chafetz Chaim. And just like Rav Rosenheim was blinded, so to say, by Rav Hirsch, as probably anyone would be, but he went over to Eastern Europe, and he met the great Gedolim in Eastern Europe. He was blinded by them as well. And he wrote a book called Samson Raphael Hirsch's Cultural Ideal in Our Times, and it's apologia, there's no other way to put it. I actually started reading it, and I could not make my way through it, because it's clearly explaining Rav Hirsch in a very different way than I understand Rav Hirsch to be. But I think that the idea that, in the Hirshian world at least, Rav Hirsch may have meant his system to be just an emergency measure comes from Moreno Yaakov Rosenheim. Now, coming from the East itself, from Eastern Europe, we have the famous Rav Baruch Ber in his Sefer Birchas Shmuel on Kiddushin. He writes that since Rav Hirsch was such a tzaddik and was so amazing and so great, there is no way he advocated secular studies except to fight Haskalah. That was it. He could not have had any other motivation, and clearly Torim Derech Eretz was only meant to be temporary, and Rav Hirsch was great tzaddik and he would never mention anything else. And that's what Rav Baruch Ber says. Now, clearly Rav Baruch Ber never read any of Rav Hirsch's writings. He didn't know German, and for an Eastern European gadol who was steeped in Torah and not in really anything else, to imagine that a gadol purposely, a known gadol, purposely pushed secular studies, I guess was really against the grain. And this was his conclusion that he comes out to. Unfortunately, anyone who reads Rav Hirsch's writings will never come to such a conclusion, and we're going to prove that soon. But I believe that this is how, in the yeshiva world, it became such a prevalent thing to say that really you shouldn't follow Rav Hirsch because it is a bidyeved horas shah system. Now, I should just mention as a side that we did discuss already Rav Dessler, who was not such a fan of Torah Derech Eretz, and Rav Schwab's response to Rav Dessler. But we're going to leave that on the side for now, and we're just going to focus on Rav Hirsch's writings and see what conclusion we come out with ourselves. Now, of course, it's impossible to quote everything, but the more we can quote from Rav Hirsch's own words, the more we could prove the point that Torah Derech Eretz was never meant to be a horas shah. So let's start in the Collective Writings, Volume 5, and this is on page 287. Now, the Collective Writings, Volume 5, is generally about the origin of the oral law, which is what it says on the back of the book. And in it, you find Rav Hirsch fighting with different reformers of the time in terms of how we look and examine the oral law. And in the beginning of the essay, the editor writes, "This essay was composed in reply to attacks made against Rav Hirsch." So let's see, second line on 287. "Ever since we have attempted to make some small contribution with voice and deed and pen within the Jewish community and for the cause of Judaism, it has been our endeavor to demonstrate precisely how intimately Judaism, we mean Judaism in its unabridged totality, is wedded with the spirit of all true science and knowledge. It has been our aim to show that this Judaism, this complete Judaism, Toras Hashem Timima, does not belong to an antiquated past, but to the vigorous, pulsating life of the present. In fact, all the future, with the answers that men expect from it to all their social and spiritual problems, belongs to that very Judaism, that whole complete Judaism. The gap that still separates our actual achievements from what we seek to accomplish is not the point under discussion here, but the fact that precisely this is our aim and our ambition can be seen clearly from our each and every word, and this is the subject of our discussion. And precisely because this is our objective, precisely because we want to see Jewish life and Jewish scholarship understood in the light of true science and knowledge, because to the extent of our limited insight, we can see the survival and future flowering of Judaism only in terms of an intimate union with the spirit of true science and knowledge in every age. We are the most avowed foes of all spurious science and knowledge, and of any attempt, under the misappropriated mask of scientific research, to lay the axe to the very roots of our sacred Jewish heritage. Any spurious scholarship of this sort undermines not Judaism, because Judaism will outlive us all, but the flowering of true scholarship in Judaism. For such, quote-unquote, research must of necessity give any sincere Jew who is not familiar with scholarship the impression, based on his own limited experience, that any endeavor at scientific scholarly research is a threat to Judaism. And that is why we regard Dr. Beer and his associates as the most dangerous enemies of scholarly research in Judaism. For if it were indeed true that there was no alternative, if any attempt at scholarly research per se were indeed capable of shaking the very foundations of Judaism as it was given to the House of Israel for its eternal mission, never to be abridged, if we had only a choice between Judaism and science, then we would simply have no other alternative. In that case, every Jew would decide, without a moment's hesitation, Mutav eya shota kol yomai, velo eya rasha shah achas bifnei avisha bashamayim. Better a Jew without science than a science without Judaism. But thank God, it is not necessary for us to make such a choice. Okay, so moving along to Volume 6. And here we have the open letters that went back and forth between Rav Hirsch and Rav Bamberger. And here Rav Hirsch is writing to Rav Bamberger. He writes on page 221, "But Torah Derech Eretz is nevertheless the one true principle conducive to truth and peace, to healing and recovery from all ills and all religious confusion. The principle of Torah Derech Eretz can fulfill this function because it is not part of troubled, time-bound notions. It represents the ancient, traditional wisdom of our sages that has stood the test everywhere and at all times. These sages, and they alone, have always been and still are our Chachamim Be'emes. Now, it's very hard to read a statement like that, where Rav Hirsch explicitly says that it's not part of troubled time-bound notions and it's the ancient traditional wisdom of our sages that has stood the test at all times and places and say, well, he never really meant it, that it was just an emergency measure that was stuck in. Not true at all. He most certainly meant this as an absolute lechachila. But let us continue. The following comes from Judaism Eternal, which we've read from in the past, and this is a two-volume series which includes some of Rav Hirsch's works that were translated into English from Diane Grunfeld. So let's read from volume 2, page 234, Our Principle. Now, what is it that we want? Are the only alternatives either to abandon religion or to renounce all progress with all the glorious and noble gifts which civilization and education offer mankind? Is the Jewish religion really of such a nature that its faithful adherents must be enemies of civilization and progress? Is it true that our synagogue and school, and Rav Hirsch here means the ones that he started, are in league with reaction, that as the result of our endeavors, Jews will in the future again acquire the same education and manners, and with them enjoy the same degree of respect as was their lot in past centuries? We declare before heaven and earth that if our religion demanded that we should renounce what is called civilization and progress, we would obey unquestioningly, because our religion is for us truly religion, the word of God, before which every other consideration has to give way. We declare equally that we would prefer to be branded as fools and do without all the honor and glory that civilization and progress might confer on us, rather than be guilty of the conceited mock wisdom which the spokesman of a religion allied to progress here displays. But behold, whither a religion allied to progress leads. Behold, how void it is of all piety and humanity, and into what blunders the conceited, Torah-criticizing spirit leads. Here you have a protagonist of this religion of progress. See how he dances on the graves of your forefathers, how he drags out their corpses from their graves, laughs in their faces and exclaims to you, your fathers were crude and uncivilized. They deserve the contempt in which they were held. Follow me, so that you may become civilized and deserve respect. Such is the craziness which grows on the tree of knowledge of this quote-unquote religion allied to progress. If our choice were only between such craziness and simple ignorance, again, we say we would remain ignorant all our life long, rather than be thus godlessly educated even for one moment. There is, however, no such dilemma. Judaism never remained aloof from true civilization and progress. In almost every era, its adherents were fully abreast of contemporary learning and very often excelled their contemporaries. If in recent centuries, German Jews remained more or less aloof from European civilization, the fault lay not in their religion, but in the tyranny which confined them by force within the walls of their ghettos, and denied them intercourse with the outside world. And, thank goodness, even now our sons and daughters can compare favorably in culture and moral worth with the children of those families who have forsaken the religion of their forefathers for the sake of imagined progress. They need not shun the light of publicity or the critical eye of their contemporaries. They have lost nothing in culture or refinement, even though they do not smoke their cigars on the Shabbos, even though they do not seek the pleasures of the table in foods forbidden by God, even though they do not desecrate the Shabbos for the sake of profit and enjoyment. Indeed, we are short-sighted enough to believe that the Jew, who remains steadfast amidst the scoffing and the enticements of the easygoing world around him, who remains strong enough to sacrifice to God's will profit, inclination, and the respect and applause of his fellows, displays far greater moral strength and thus a higher degree of real culture than the frivolous modern Jew, whose principles melt away before the first contemptuous glance or at the slightest prospect of profit, and who is unfaithful to the word of God and the teachings of his fathers in order to satisfy the whim of the moment. As for our school, only a slanderer could maintain that it is wedded to reaction and to the rejection of civilization and culture. Its teachers compare favorably in educational and general knowledge with those of the most highly esteemed schools here, and the fact that they have a sound knowledge of Jewish learning and faithfully share the adherence of our congregation to our paternal religion in no way impairs their scholarship, their culture, and their teaching ability. Public examinations have proven how efficient their methods have been in bringing the school fully up to the level of similar non-Jewish institutions. If, then, our aims also include the conscientious promotion of education and culture, and we have clearly expressed this in the motto of our congregation, Yafet Talmud Torah Derech Eretz, thereby building on the same foundations as those which were laid by our sages of old. So clearly, this and much of what we're reading is polemical, but again, it's very difficult to say that this wasn't said as it's written. It's written very strongly, and it's written with someone who has full conviction that what he's doing is 100% correct. So let's move on now to Volume 7 in the Collective Writings. And this is one of my favorite volumes. It involves education. And we'll start on page 12. And this is in an essay entitled Principles of Education. It must be remembered, of course, that the Jews of the era to which we are referring had to contend themselves with the knowledge of the facts and phenomena of nature in terms of their physical impact on man. In most instances, they had to forgo the study of nature per se, i.e., the study of the significance of natural facts and phenomena beyond their direct relationships to man. The reason for this was not that the study of life was considered incompatible with the study of the facts and phenomena of nature and history, or that the former had no use for the latter, or that the former had cause to feel threatened by the latter. In fact, an insight into the nature of things and the history of man can only be most welcome to that kind of study which sees as its purpose the practical implementation of the will of Him who created the nature of things, who guides the history of mankind, and who tells us what we should be in relation to nature and history. But the times to which we are referring were too unfavorable to permit an insight into the things and phenomena of nature and history. The narrow slits of open sky that were visible from between the tall, somber tenements of the ghettos were hardly conducive to a thoughtful observation of the heavens and their wonders. The high walls that imprisoned the Jewish youths in the alleys of the ghettos also barred them from field and forest, from nature and its beauties. Often, the frail bean sprout that a Jewish lad might plant and nurture in front of the dark, narrow window of the dwelling in which he lived was all he ever knew of springtime. All that world history had to offer the Jews were chains and auto da fe. During an age when the rest of mankind filled history's annals with such a poor reflection of itself in the form of Jewish blood, Jewish tears, and Jewish ruin, Israel could hardly be blamed for having little desire or inclination to read the pages of history. And yet, the Jewish perspective even then was never so narrow as we tend to believe today. The age of ghettos and burnings at the stake had been preceded by centuries during which Jewish sages, the sages of Jewish scholarship, had been, at the same time, pillars of the general science of heaven and earth. Nearly every page of the literature that was treasured in ghetto tenements bore witness to the author's deep insights into the nature of things and their relationship to one another, and into the nature of man and his social development. Moreover, there was within the souls of Jewish men and women a horizon far broader than the small strip of sky visible from the alleys in which the Jews were confined. In their hearts there shone a light of truth and clarity, a sun of peace and serenity, that not even the oppressive darkness of their dwellings and even darker realities outside could obscure. And so they did not really miss engaging in science or that culture which they knew to be incapable of rescuing its disciples from the shackles of shameful delusion and deplorable error. It was precisely in this isolated state in which both Jewish scholarship and the Jewish people found themselves that Jewish scholarship gave proof of the divine strength which is inherent in it, of the light that refreshes the soul, brightens the eyes, and gladdens the heart. Even when it was turned inward upon itself and its wellsprings, Jewish scholarship was capable of enlightening, strengthening, ennobling, uplifting, comforting, and sustaining an entire nation as long as that nation dedicated itself to these studies with a loyal, devoted, and sincere love. I'm going to skip now to page 19. But what about the realities of our modern age, you may argue? Our children have so much to learn, so many things to study. We have left the narrow confines of the ghetto behind us. We are moving about in freedom, and our children will be able to move about even more freely in the world outside. Modern life makes many new and complex demands on the cultured, educated person. We can no longer afford the time for old-style Hebrew lessons in our courses of study. Should we allow our children to lag behind their other contemporaries in education and culture? Should they not be given an opportunity to be on par with all the others in the knowledge of languages and the sciences? Should we permit our children to preserve in their own lives the narrow, limited horizons of the old-time ghettos? Should we expect them to forgo all the intellectual advantages of our modern age? No, certainly not. If a choice of either or were placed before us, either to keep our children ignorant of all the knowledge that alone can train the Jew by truth to become a Jew also in spirit, or else to withhold from them many of the treasures of modern culture and education, if we would have to choose between the one and the other, then no matter how fierce the opposition we would have to expect from many of our contemporaries, we should not hesitate for even a moment to take our stand. This is very similar to what we read before. If we were forced to choose between the one and the other, then as Jews, we would have to forgo all the intellectual advantages that could be obtained only at the sacrifice of the Jewish spirit of our children. After all, our forefathers had to make many much greater sacrifices for their Judaism. If we were compelled to choose, we would have to say, Judaism comes first, and general education only thereafter. When we held our infant sons in our arms to enter them into the covenant of Abraham, we declared before God that we would raise them as Jews also in intellect and spirit. On that occasion, our friends expressed the wish that we might be able to raise our sons l'Torah. Only after that came l'chuppah ul'ma'asim tovim. This implies that their training in the skills of life will have significance and value before God only if their entire intellectual and spiritual development is based on the broad foundations of God's law, only if their lives become firmly rooted in the divine soil of Judaism. But precisely because our children will be able to move about even more freely in the world outside, and precisely because our children, certainly more so than their fathers, and perhaps even more so than we ourselves, will come into close contact with and frequently have to meet challenges posed by the studies, creations, viewpoints, principles, and concepts developed by non-Jewish minds, will they be all the more in need of a thorough Jewish education so that they will learn to know and appreciate their Judaism and feel the light and the truth that radiate from it. Our children must be helped to savor the treasures that have been handed down to them from the spiritual giants of the millennia of Jewish history, lest they come to think that they must look elsewhere for light and life, for heart and mind, because their own ancestral heritage is so dull and somber. We must see to it that the melodies of the lyre of Judaism, the visions of the Jewish spirit that have inspired Jewish hearts, and the words that have been uttered by Jewish lips should find an echo also in the souls of our children. Above all, our children should be trained to apply the divine truths of Judaism as a test and a standard by which to evaluate all the creations, views, principles, and axioms developed by non-Jewish minds, so that they should not be dazzled and led astray by these creations, no matter how great and splendid. They should be able to see clearly that the past 2,000 years have not seen the emergence of any truly noble or world-redeeming idea that did not first ripen upon the tree of Jewish knowledge. In the ghetto, it was possible to transmit the Jewish heritage by the mere power of personal upbringing. But in the marketplaces of the modern world, Judaism can be preserved only by the power of the mind. If, therefore, we would have to choose between the one and the other, there could be no doubt about the choice we would have to make. Judaism would have to come first, and general education only thereafter. But thank God, we do not have to make such a choice. Our children need not forego the benefits of a worthwhile secular education. They need not sacrifice opportunities for the study of the arts and sciences in order to obtain all the treasures of truth and wisdom that Judaism holds for their lives. If both studies are nurtured hand in hand, there will be ample room for both. The one will reinforce the other, and the result will be a Jewish education that will find favor in the eyes of both God and man. Continuing on page 23, but there is another way. Gather together in groups large and small and join hands, all of you who are still sincere about Judaism and who would be deeply distressed if any child of yours were ever to join the ranks of those who feel only scorn and contempt for their Jewish heritage and who are ready to destroy it. Join hands, all of you whom even the most brilliant successes your child might achieve would be no consolation, no compensation for such unhappiness. Join hands to provide your children with an integrated, well-balanced, total education. Choose teachers who are Jewishly educated and at the same time educated Jews. Teachers whose own hearts and minds have already been educated to achieve the integration of Jewish and general studies. Teachers who themselves worked earnestly and diligently to imbibe Jewish knowledge and labored with equal earnestness and diligence to acquire the same thorough grounding in the treasures that secular education has to offer. Teachers whose hearts and minds are rooted in Judaism, but who also know how to appreciate the values of Judaism from the perspective of the world outside, and conversely, how to test the values of the world outside from the perspective of Judaism. Teachers whose culture and attitude you would be happy to have your children emulate someday. Seek out such teachers. Poor though our age may be, you will still be able to find such men. Such Ud Mutzal Me'esh, which is a pasuk based on Zechariah. Others have sought teachers of this caliber and have found them. If you search for them, you too will find them, if only you desire it. One of the things we've pointed out in the past, the reasons that Torah Derech Eretz does not necessarily propagate, is because most people that are teaching are products of the yeshiva system with that outlook on life, as opposed to a Torah Derech Eretz outlook. Continuing, entrust your children to such educators so that they may be guided at an early age in both fields of study, at the same time with equal earnestness and equal nurturing attention. In the hands of these educators, the two fields of study will become as one unit, one function, both directed toward the same objective, to open the hearts and minds of our young people to the original sources of divine truth and of the wisdom of our fathers, so that they may learn to appreciate their calling as human beings and as Jews, and learn how to draw from these sources enlightenment and sanctity for both the joyous and solemn moments of their lives. Give your children such educators who will teach them to view the understanding of nature and history as a means for the accomplishment of their mission as men and as Jews, and to develop all their faculties, skills, and abilities to their maximum potential, so that they may be able to discharge their divinely ordained task. To achieve this end, why not employ the age-old principle in Avos of Talmud Torah im Derech Eretz, which weds religious and secular education to one another in mutual interdependence? If you will do so, you will see, even in your own lifetime, how Yigias Shinehem, how the careful, simultaneous cultivation of both these elements of education, Mishkachas Avon, will guard your children against error on both sides. You will see with what zest and devotion your children will take to their Hebrew studies and drink in that spirit of the law of God and the wisdom of our sages, and how nevertheless, or perhaps precisely because of the special education they have received, they will be capable of competing on an equal basis with their contemporaries in the acquisition of all the knowledge, talents, and skills that are part of their general education as members of the larger society. The realm of Jewish learning is not insular, remote from nature, from history, from the world, and from the realities of life. On the contrary, it calls upon its disciples to study the heavens and the earth, to reflect on the connections that link the events and developments of history, to take an active part in every phase of physical, intellectual, moral, and social life, and to gain the clearest, sharpest possible insight into all things and their relationship to one another. Moreover, consider that Hebrew, the language of the sacred literature of Judaism, because of the simple construction of its roots and forms, is singularly suited, as hardly any other, to stimulate and develop the powers of the human intellect and the aptitude for languages. As a consequence, Jewish learning can relate to every field of secular studies, helping in furthering their aims, even as, in turn, it may look to secular learning for help and furtherance. And so, these two areas of learning do not hamper one another, are not mutually detrimental. Rather, they can strengthen and reinforce one another in such a manner that the lofty goal toward which we strive in the education of our young can be promoted and achieved in the framework of normal school hours without subjecting our young students to undue mental strain. And what is the goal? It is to educate our children to satisfy all the just demands that will be placed upon them by the age in which they live, on the one hand, and by Judaism on the other, equipped with the best of all truly humanistic training and guided by the Jewish law of God and the heritage of our sages that will constantly give them new strength, light, counsel, admonition, consolation, and inspiration. They will be able to meet the challenges that life will hold for them. So once again, very self-explanatory, very clear-cut. So let us move on to our next source. And this one's much shorter, from the same volume on page 63. This is the very first paragraph in an essay entitled, The Role of Hebrew Study in General Education. In keeping with its educational program, our school accords the same serious and devoted attention to subjects of general studies as it does to what is commonly regarded as specifically Jewish education. From the very beginning, our school has been aware that, in carrying out the task it has set for itself, it has combined two distinct elements that are considered mutually exclusive by prejudiced outsiders with a superficial point of view. One, they claim, must of necessity limit the other by virtue of the time and energy required to do justice to both. You still hear this again today, all the time. Our school, by contrast, has been of the opinion from the outset that these two elements, although commonly viewed as mutually limiting antitheses, and even considered by some as nullifying one another, are in fact two closely related, mutually complementary parts of one greater integrated educational unity. In practical life, this unity produces a Jew with moral and spiritual training in the general culture of mankind, a man and a citizen with a moral and spiritual education in the values of Judaism. As a consequence, the school, which should be the nursery for practical life, should promote both these elements in such a manner that they will complement and support one another to form one harmonious whole. Okay, now this brings us to our last source from Rav Hirsch. And I just want to point out the reason that I keep going on and on and on with more and more sources is because this is such a canard to say that Rav Hirsch never really meant what he was saying as a lechachila, and it's only a Horas Shah. It's, if you read any of Rav Hirsch, such an idea, such a concept is just crazy. So the more we can quote, the more we see from the words of Rav Hirsch himself, the more obvious this becomes. So our last source begins on page 82, and this is from an essay entitled, The Relevance of Secular Studies. At first glance, our answer to this question in the pages that follow might be of interest primarily to the Jewish circles closest to our own. There are proponents of Jewish studies who view any attempt to give our youth a secular education as a sacrifice of time and energy that should be devoted to things Jewish. They may sanction this sacrifice as a concession to the demands of the present day, but they will deplore it and will feel deeply concerned about the influence that an educational element they consider alien to Judaism will have on the future Jewish attitude and lifestyle of our youth. Now this sums up the Eastern European concern, as well as showing us that Rav Hirsch was well aware that people thought this was a Horas Shah, and he's clearly telling you, no, it's not. In view of the fact that our institution gives the same earnest and devoted attention to general education as it does to Jewish studies, and indeed has explicitly stressed the study of both of these two elements as part of its educational outlook, it would be important to demonstrate to the Jewish friends of our institution the close connection between these two fields of education and the significant benefits which secular studies have to offer to the future philosophy and lifestyle of our Jewish youth. However, in the interest of explaining our efforts to the broader community, it would seem desirable to demonstrate the close relationship between these two fields of study also to wider circles, so that they too may gain a better understanding of our objectives. The question whether a school embraces all its fields of study with equal enthusiasm out of a deep inner conviction, or because it is forced to do so by circumstances beyond its control, certainly cannot be a matter of indifference to those whose trust the school hopes to obtain for its endeavors. Only ideas rooted in genuine conviction will be received with enthusiasm. Products of compromise can expect no more than grudging acceptance forced by considerations of expediency. On the very day our institution first opened its doors 14 years ago, there were those who felt called upon to turn public opinion against our school by claiming that Orthodox Jews would never give sincere support to secular education. Today, 14 years later, we can look back with gratification on those good luck wishes from our adversaries, all the more so sincere we can happily note how soon many of these skeptics came to jettison their prejudiced view to give full credit to our institution for its accomplishments in the field of secular studies. As a result, our reflections today can be truly and calmly objective. Thank God, we no longer have any need for apologetics. We should not be surprised to note that initially some sincere, inspired disciples of Jewish studies and Jewish life viewed the introduction of the young to the realm of secular education with a measure of alarm that has not subsided in certain circles to this very day. We are certain that these apprehensions are based only on preconceived notions. They take root wherever two supposedly antithetical elements of education are seen from a narrow, one-sided point of view, and neither can, therefore, be understood in terms of its true significance. Lack of understanding always breeds prejudice. To understand the roots of the notion that Jewish studies and secular education conflict with one another, we must go back to the beginning of the present century, when the sons of the Jewish people emerged from centuries of enforced isolation, and, after hundreds of years, resumed contact once again with the elements of secular knowledge. We say resumed and once again because this isolation and estrangement from the secular world was never a condition of Judaism. This can be amply demonstrated by the shining annals of Jewish culture and literature left to us from happier times. When the Jews were free to leave the ghettos, they found that the elements of secular education were in conflict with their religious traditions, indeed, with the views of religion in general. Even in our own day, when we have long passed the middle of our present century, this conflict still acts as a ferment, constantly exercising the minds of the Gentile world, with supporters rallying to either side of the struggle between faith and knowledge, between the church and science. Given the keen intelligence of that generation of Jews, should it come as a surprise to us that as soon as Jews made contact with the elements that had bred the notion of a struggle between religion and knowledge, the notion of this conflict should have spread throughout the Jewish camp? Should we be surprised to note that this development of necessity caused such a violent upheaval, particularly in the Jewish camp, where religion does not concern itself only with one aspect of human life, but embraces the totality of moral, spiritual, and social existence? Should we really be surprised that the younger generation should have given themselves unquestioningly to what they perceived as the spirit of a new age, heralding their liberation at long last from oppression and indignity and social prejudice? Should we be surprised that, as a consequence, they should have followed the lead of this new spirit also when it declared war on what it branded as outdated religious notions? It was only natural that, under the spell of this perverted view of religion being in conflict with knowledge, the younger generation of Jews soon turned against the spirit of the religion of their fathers, regarding it as the spirit that had kept them in social enslavement. Should we be surprised that the older generation, particularly the acknowledged guardians of our ancestral religious heritage, reacted with consternation to this onslaught of the new era? The younger generation of Jews were declaring war upon everything that, for thousands of years, had given their people the knowledge, the inspiration, and the moral stamina that enabled them to survive even in the face of oppression and degradation, and to triumph over the ordeals that marked their path through history. Should we blame that older generation for rejecting a new era which, by deliberately encouraging the neglect of Jewish studies, raised Jewish youth to despise the heritage of its ancestral religion, so that eventually this youth went so far as to denounce the literature of the Jewish religion to the governmental authorities as inimical to culture. Precisely this is what happened in our own city of Frankfurt. In response to denunciations from Jews, the city fathers, with the best intentions in the world, lent their authority to an effort to stifle the ancient religion of Judaism by restricting and even prohibiting the activities of Jewish educational, cultural, and religious institutions. Almost 50 years of struggle had to pass before our community could emerge and reestablish the time-honored religious communal life that had been so wantonly destroyed. Should it surprise us, therefore, that the older generation perceived the spirit of the new culture, which had been used as a vehicle to attack their ancient heritage, as the cause of all their troubles? Was it surprising that the elders considered it their duty to keep away from the new culture and to make sure that their followers, too, would have nothing to do with it? Can we fault these elders and their disciples for the refusal to trust the elements of a culture whose bearers were hostile to religion? In light of all the foregoing, should we be surprised that these two tendencies became increasingly alienated from one another to a point where they lived in complete ignorance and misapprehension of each other's characters and objectives? The educated and cultured Jews simply ignored Jewish life and scholarship, while those who remained loyal to these Jewish values completely misjudged the true spirit of genuine culture. And so there developed that rift within Judaism, that spiritual wound from which our own contemporaries are still bleeding today. True, we should not be surprised at what happened, but we must deplore the conditions that caused these developments. The social renaissance of the Jewish nation, ushered in by the beginning of the present century, came about under the impact of such unexpected world-shaking events that when the Jews were plunged from their former isolation into the mainstream of modern European culture, they were thrown into a state of complete shock in both directions. It is sad to think that the Jewish leaders of that period allowed themselves to lose their awareness of the character and intellectual depth and clarity of Judaism in both theory and practice, which certainly cannot be viewed as contrary to the essence of anything genuinely good and true produced by human civilization through the ages. We should be filled with sadness at the thought that because the political position of their people forced them to isolate themselves from the intellectual tendencies of the world outside, the giants of Jewish learning, of whom there certainly was no lack in those days, were prevented from examining these intellectual tendencies at first hand. Had they been in a position to do so, their broad vision surely would have enabled them to welcome everything good and true in general culture as eminently compatible with the views of Judaism. They would then have to be the first to see to it that their disciples, too, became familiar with all that is good and true in genuine culture. It is sad to think that the ideas of a conflict between faith and knowledge, which might have been justifiable in the case of some other creeds, was cavalierly applied also to Judaism without considering whether it was indeed applicable to Jewish thought and practice, or whether, given the uniqueness of the Jewish faith, the notion of such a conflict would lose its relevance. The truth is that the attitude of Judaism toward all other religious faiths and all human intellectual pursuits differs basically from the attitude of other religions. Judaism is probably the only religion that does not declare there is no salvation outside of myself, that happily welcomes any intellectual or moral advance, no matter what its origin. Indeed, the timeless words of the Jewish prophets look with firm assurance to the ever-growing, ever-spreading spiritual and moral ennoblement, not only of the Jews, but of all mankind. Judaism is probably the only religion that teaches its followers to view not only the early light of dawn, the blossoms of springtime, the darkness of thunder, the flashes of lightning, not only the sight of anything beautiful, sublime, powerful, or beneficial in nature, but also the sight of any human being great in wisdom or knowledge, no matter what his nationality or religion, as a revelation of the divine. Whenever Jews behold such an individual, they must pronounce a blessing in praise of God who has given of his wisdom to mortals. In the view of Judaism, truth is one and indivisible, just like its original source, the one God. Therefore, the perception of truth, too, must be one and indivisible. Okay, let's skip to the top of page 87. Judaism knows that even a natural scientist who denies the existence of God actually confirms his existence with every new insight he gains from an idea, a mechanism, or a law of nature he observes in the course of his research. He may insist that there is no God, but his own discoveries attest to the existence of one God who embodied his thought in the particular phenomena observed by the scientist, and who has made the substances and forces operative in these phenomena subject to his law. Truly, a scientist who denies the existence of God actually confirms his existence whenever he sets out to study particular phenomena in order to abstract from them the concepts and laws that govern nature and history. The teachings of Judaism have nothing to fear from science. So again, all of this is self-explanatory to show us that Rav Hirsch never meant Torah Derech Eretz to be a Horas Shah. So let's continue on the bottom of page 87. Now, if the Judaism for which we are educating our young need not shrink from contact with the intellectual elements of any other true culture, it is essential for the future of our youth as citizens, and therefore it is a true religious duty for us to give them a secular education. A secular education is a most beneficial help to our young in understanding the times in which they live and the conditions under which they will have to practice their life's vocation. Hence, it is most desirable also from the Jewish religious viewpoint and consequently deserving of warm support. But at the same time, and even more important, a good secular education can give our young people substantial new insights, added dimensions that will enrich their religious training. For this reason, too, secular education deserves the support of the religious educator. There is no need to cite specific evidence that most of the secular studies taught at higher educational institutions, including our own, are essential to the future vocational careers of the students. There seem to be no differences of opinion in this respect. However, any supporter of education and culture should deplore the fact that when these secular studies are evaluated in terms of their usefulness to the young, too much stress is often placed on so-called practical utility and necessity. Under such circumstances, the young are in danger of losing the pure joy of acquiring knowledge for its own sake, so that they will no longer take pleasure in the moral and spiritual benefits to be obtained from study. There is only one point we believe we must mention in support of the utilitarian view of secular education. The training of the young in skills that will earn them a respectable livelihood as adults is a sacred duty, also from which religious point of view. According to Jewish tradition, a father who fails to give his child such training himself, or fails to provide for such training, is to be considered as one who teaches his child to become a dishonest adult. Thus, the general education of our youth should be conducted with religious punctiliousness, even from the viewpoint of his future vocation. But it seems to us that no thinking Jew, aware of his mission as a Jew, should deny that, quite aside from considerations of vocational and professional education, it is also essential that young Jews, particularly those of our own times, should learn about the factors that influence the life of modern nations. In other words, they should be introduced to those branches of study that will enable them to acquire this knowledge. This would hold true even if we were not so fortunate to be living at the dawn of an era, at the beginning of a new humaneness, signified first of all by a purer sense of justice, inviting also the sons of the Jewish people to join actively in all the humane, social, and political endeavors of the nations. Now there's an editor's note on the bottom of the page, and it says the author refers to the emancipation of his time, during which the political, social, and economic conditions for Jews were far easier than during the Middle Ages. He felt that this was the beginning of a new era in terms of goodness and kindness in human relationships. And we've discussed this in the past. Even if our present-day contacts with general culture were merely passive, as they were in the days of our parents, it would be of vital religious importance for us to see that our young people should be guided toward that high level of insight which would enable them to evaluate from the vantage point of truth and justice all the personal, social, political, and religious conditions under which they would have to discharge their duties as Jews and as citizens. But now that our young people will be given an opportunity to participate in the public affairs of the land in which we live, how much more important is it that they should receive the education they will need in order that they may enthusiastically embrace all that is good and noble in the European culture of our day? Within those contexts, they will have to perform also their own mission as Jews. Only knowledge, the ability to realize when we have erred in judging our fellow men, can guard us from such prejudice. Lack of knowledge always breeds illusion and prejudice. If only non-Jewish schools were to acquaint their students with Jewish knowledge, with Jewish life, and with the conditions under which Jews live and work, to a degree even remotely approaching the diligence with which students at Jewish schools are taught about the spirit and the aspirations of the non-Jewish world, if only non-Jewish youth were taught about the spiritual and practical life of the Jewish world with the same respect and appreciation as the Jewish youth in their schools learn to respect the non-Jewish world, past and present, by studying literature and history of that world and its outstanding figures. If this wish were to come true, then all that is most human and divine within man would unite to build a bridge of love and respect between man and man. One spirit would learn to respect the other, one heart would learn to love the other, and the radiant, warming light of knowledge would gradually dispel the darkness of prejudice that still envelops so much of the world today. In light of what has just been said, it is clear, even from the religious point of view, that if our young people are to cope successfully with the practical aspects of their mission as Jews, everything possible must be done to introduce them to various areas of general studies. But there is also a spiritual harvest that can be won from secular studies, even for those who seek to grow in the theoretical knowledge of the Jewish religion. Our understanding of the philosophy of life and the Weltanschauung taught in the sacred writings of the Jewish religion is dependent in no small measure on our insights into the character and the development of nature and society. Any knowledge that serves to enrich the intellect in any manner that will also enhance our insights into the philosophy of Judaism. Okay, so that's really an awesome essay, and you may want to read the rest of it. It's really, really good. And with this, we'll conclude our look into Rav Hirsch's actual writings. Let's move on and see one secondary source. So Rav Breuer actually has an essay on this entitled Relevance of the Torah in Derech Eretz Ideal, but I'd like to skip it because, especially if you're talking to a yeshivish person, Rav Breuer will not have too much influence. Because they'll say, well, of course Rav Breuer followed Rav Hirsch, he was his grandson, etc. So if we want to give something a little more powerful, we would go to Rav Schwab, and in the book Selected Speeches, on page 239, Rav Schwab discusses his understanding of Torah Derech Eretz that he had throughout his life. So this begins on page 239. I beg your indulgence to bear with me while I relate to you some of my personal experiences. When I was 25 years old and a Rav in Ichenhausen, I wrote a controversial book called Homecoming into Judaism. The year was 1934. This was the time when Hitler, Yimach Shemo, was in power, and we all witnessed the end of the short historical era of emancipation of Germany's Jews. We saw the return to the ghetto, the return to the Middle Ages. We saw the abdication of the German humanistic ideal on which we had been brought up. All that had a traumatic effect on me, as well as on many others. So I decided to say goodnight to the German culture and to bid farewell to my Torah Derech Eretz heritage with which I was brought up. Instead, I opted in favor of a Torah-only return by the masses to the Beis HaMidrash of old, back to the very simple and frugal existence in which one seeks total happiness by immersing oneself in Limud HaTorah, as our forefathers did in the Middle Ages. Thus, we would find inner peace and emotional safety. As to Rav Hirsch's ideal of Torah Derech Eretz, I was of the opinion that this had been merely a Horas Shah. It was a time-bound halachic compromise which was highly successful during the 19th century in saving the remnants of European Jewry from total oblivion in the flood of heresy which had by then inundated Western Europe. So about 50 years ago, I wrote as follows, and I quote myself. It came to pass in the days of Ahav, king of Israel. Our people were assembled upon Har Carmel. The only one to stand firm in the midst of public confusion was Eliyahu HaNavi. He knows that in order to demonstrate the existence of the one true God, he must use the same methods which the idolaters employed. Like them, he too must now erect an altar, but this time it is an altar in honor of Hashem. However, the Torah forbids the offering of sacrifices outside the Beis HaMikdash. But when he sees an entire people waiting in suspense, hearts hammering in breathless anticipation for a divine sign from heaven, Eliyahu HaNavi knows what he must do, namely, to decide on a Horas Shah, a halachic emergency ruling to which a Navi is entitled, and to build a Bama on Har HaKarmel. He brings a sacrifice which is consumed by a fire from heaven, and so he succeeds in drawing from the lips of his estranged brethren the proclamation of a national homecoming to God. Hashem Hu Ho Elokim, Hashem Hu Ho Elokim. I continue to quote, let us recall for a moment the unfortunate era that followed Moses Mendelssohn. Western European culture had caught Jewish consciousness off balance. The hunger for modern studies, for good form, for the right to play a part in the concept of Europe, intensified beyond endurance. The unscrupulous priestcraft of reform set up Jewish souls for total assimilation. Tens of thousands openly deserted. And so the eyes of all those who were troubled by these developments scanned the Jewish horizon for a ray of hope, for someone who would rescue Western European Jewry from the spiritual affliction that was threatening its very survival. And then he appeared, the gifted teacher, the inspired educator, the fighter, the victor, who alone was able to make the great thrust. With indomitable courage, he reconquered position after position and stemmed the devastating tide of perfidy. He became a guide through a labyrinth of conflicting and confusing paths. Samson Raphael Hirsch was the historical hero of that period because he was able to find that redeeming, militant device which could stop assimilation short. This saintly fighter, filled with the zeal of Pinchas, emulated the dauntless daring of Eliyahu. He, too, promulgated an emergency ruling in the hour of his nation's agony. The device of Torah Derech Eretz became essential to Israel's survival. However, it was not meant to be anything more than a temporary arrangement, not an ideal state of affairs. The synthesis between Torah and culture could be obtained only as long as the overwhelming impact of a seemingly impressive culture remained unbroken, keeping alive the illusion that the Torah was outmoded. It was not Rav Hirsch who wedded culture with Jewishness. He only found himself faced with a situation that had long been a fait accompli. What he did was to respond to the challenge by choosing the only possible path, to make a virtue of a necessity in order to preserve the claim of the Torah. Imbued with love of mankind as he was, he looked at all the accomplishments of culture in his day as the radiant harbingers of the footsteps of Mashiach. He was confident that the people of Europe, civilized men if you will, reared by Schiller and Goethe, by Leibniz, Wolff, and Schleiermacher, by Kant, Fichte, and Hegel, would produce an ethical harvest that would eventually accord with the will of Hashem and could be integrated in the solid spiritual structure of Torah ideology. I still remember a German poem that was required reading in all classes. Let man be noble, helping, and good. Surely, this device could be seen as a threshold to the sanctuary of Torah, and sufficient to justify Rav Hirsch's Horas Shah. But who could have foreseen that man, in the course of his intellectual, artistic, social, and economic progress, would turn into a creature that was anything but noble, helping, and good? Rav Hirsch could not have anticipated the disillusionment of the generation of the World War, meaning World War I. There was nothing written in the stars to indicate that civilized mankind, reared on the classics and the works of the philosophers would eventually march into the battlefields of the World War to kill each other off to the tune of 12 million victims. Not even Rehrsch's brilliant vision could have foreseen that. Reconciled Torah and European culture? It sounds very nice, except that European culture today is dominated by intellectual and political elements whose ideology can never subordinate itself to the discipline of the Torah. Not in his wildest dreams could Rehrsch have envisioned the frightening spectacle of the Jewish people the world over, cheated of its newly awakened hope, standing in shock before the remnants of a collapsing culture and subsequently embracing a new chauvinism of its own as a final quest for salvation. End of quotation. This was 1934. At the time, the satanic forces unleashed by the nation of the poets and thinkers proclaimed loudly the total bankruptcy of Western culture, Bildung, humanism, or what have you. The Nazi deviltry had only one meaning for their survivors. Lechami, bova chadarecho, skor de losecho ba'adecho, chavi chimat rega, ad ya'avor zo'am. Go, my people, come into your chambers, close your doors behind you, withdraw for a while until the storm is over. And that's based on Yeshaya, Parak 26, Pasuk Chaf. Our slogan, therefore, could then only be, back to the historic ghetto, back to the Torah-only existence. This is what I wrote and published in Hitler's Germany with all my power of conviction. The Derech Eretz, which we had known and befriended, was dead forever. Now, here comes the reversal. However, after having been rescued by the miracles and the chasadim of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, I woke up here in America only to realize that the historic intellectual ghetto to which I longed to return had gone up in flames as well. How could I have visualized that my gullus path through the desert of nations would lead me into the very stronghold of another Western civilization, this time the American style? Little did I know that the same kind of spiritual European gullus could come back again, and only more so. So about 30 years ago, I took a second view of Torah Derech Eretz by first studying in depth the writings of Rav Hirsch. Soon I found out that my notion of the Hirschian philosophy as a mere Horace Shah was totally wrong. He did not consider his leitmotif as time-bound. It was not a compromise. It was not a heter. It was not a kula. It was not meant to be bidyeved, but lichachila. True, he did not say to the Gdola Yisrael of Eastern Europe, Kablu dati, accept my opinion. He realized they would not accept his Weltanschauung. They followed Misoras Avosehem, the traditions of their teachers. But Rav Hirsch also had behind him a solid Mesorah from Gedolim who showed him the way. From the time of Chazal through the period of the Gaonim, the Rambam, Chachmei Sfarad, through the Talmidei Hagra, all the way down to his own Rebbe, the Aruch Lener, and his disciples, Rav Hirsch had his Mesorah. Okay, so that concludes what I wanted to read from Rav Schwab. And we have shown pretty clearly that any notion that Rav Hirsch meant his Torah Derech Eretz as Horas Shah is mistaken. It's not correct, based on Rav Hirsch's writings at least. And therefore, we could definitely reject such an opinion. Now, anyone more interested in this topic, there is an article, I can't quite remember the name offhand, it's either by Schneer Zalman Lyman or by J.J. Schachter. So one of these two eminent individuals wrote an article where they quote Rav Hirsch at length, I think even more so than we did, and they go out to prove that Torah Derech Eretz is not a Horas Shah. So this concludes our discussion, is Torah Derech Eretz a Horas Shah or not, and ends the entire series on the 19 letters. Baruch Nosen Layoiv Koach Ul'enonim Atzma Yarbeh. So at this point, I would just like to make a bunch of thank yous. I would like to thank Rabbi Jack Abramowitz, who runs OU Torah, for being such a fan of this project and of the many other shiurim that I've given him over time. Dr. Elliot Bondi, who initially reviewed some of my notes. I would like to thank my good friend Reb Nachi W. and also Reb Yisrael K. Both of you reviewed many of these lectures and gave me great feedback, as well as Dr. Michael D. I believe you are the first one to hear all of these lectures. and your encouragement along the way was very, very helpful. Finally, I would like to thank you for listening to this lecture series, which is well over 20 hours. And anyone who's listened to me speak that long, I could just express my admiration to you for your patience. And if you have gotten to this point, or if you just have some general feedback or comments, I really love hearing from people. Again, my email address is daniel@gmail.com. That's daniel y adler@gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening.